Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer. I'm very pleased to introduce to you Lisa Kinney, who is the co-author with Stephanie Brill of the book entitled The Transgender Teen, a handbook for parents and professionals supporting transgender and non-binary teens. And Lisa Kinney is also the executive director with Executive Spectrum. Lisa Kinney, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you, Pamela. I really appreciate it. And just to clarify, the name of the organization is Gender Spectrum. But I am executive director of the organization, and I'm really pleased to be here today. Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us about Gender Spectrum. What do you folks do?
Well, Gender Spectrum was initially formed it became a 501c3 in 2007, but it really came out of the experience of many parents, and it began in the Bay Area, and it started with a parent support group for parents who began hearing from their kids, in most cases pretty young kids, that their gender wasn't what people assumed it was, and found themselves feeling pretty isolated and pretty alone, and there really wasn't very much information about how kids come to their gender and what is gender for that matter. And we began by having a conference, and that conference, the first conference was actually in 2006, and, you know, it was about 40 people sitting in a hotel room, you know, parents and kids and some professionals, talking about what gender is and talking about what's going on with their kids. You know, fast forward, our 10th conference was last year, and over the course of 3 days, one day is a professionals symposium day, and the other 2 days is for kids and their families, there were about 1,450 people.
Oh, my.
And it gives you a sense, you know, Pamela, of what's really happening around evolving understandings of gender. And I use that as an example to just highlight the trajectory of this. And so, you know, one of the things that I find is so many people are confused. I mean, you know, they're hearing gender in the news on a regular basis, and they're hearing a lot of conversation. And you're not alone if you're wondering what's going on and what's changing and why is it changing and what are the implications of this change. And Gender Spectrum really at our core is in business to try to help folks make sense of that, to help parents certainly and families, you know, caregivers and extended family to understand what to do to talk with their child and to support their child around their gender. Certainly professionals that serve youth are experiencing this every day. And so trying to help understand what's going on there is also essential. But it's also businesses and other organizations in our society and institutions that are just, you know, trying to catch up with what's going on and to try to understand what all of this means for them, either as employers or those providing products and services to youth and their families or to any folks in a workplace even that's rapidly evolving. So it really what's happening with gender is far-reaching, and Gender Spectrum's role in that is to really try to help people understand what's going on and to reduce some of that confusion and to help find a place in which or provide places where these kinds of questions can be discussed and without judgment and to just really increase our understandings and to think together about how to incorporate these changes into our families and into our organizations and our communities.
And, of course, living in today's world, doing anything without judgment can be a challenge in and of itself.
True.
No matter what you're thinking about. But let me make sure I understand. So if I, as a parent, had a question, I could contact Gender Spectrum. If I, as a business person, wanted to figure out what I needed to do to be aware of a range of staff that I might have, I would call Gender Spectrum. If I was an agency, a hospital or a clinical agency trying to develop a program, I would call Gender Spectrum. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right, Pamela. So one of the things we do, and we do this through a number of vehicles, we do a lot of education and training, and most of that is done, we do it actually through a series of online workshops and events and some in-person workshops and events, and we do that with a range of people, whether it's educators, social service providers, you know, other sort of youth serving organizations, camp leaders and things like that. We provide a lot of trainings and content and online events to provide this information broadly. But we also do private consulting. You know, in many cases, corporations, for example, are trying to figure out what do they do about, say, a bathroom policy. And, you know, Target is not a client of ours. If you are a client of ours, nobody will ever hear us say it unless you've disclosed that, because we think it is essential that companies and anybody, for that matter, has privacy to sort these issues out on their own without feeling like they're going to be exposed. But because Target wasn't a client, they're a great example I can speak to about, you know, the uproar, I'm sure, Pamela, that you observed as well around what it meant when they said that they were going to provide the ability for Target customers to use the bathroom that was appropriate for them based on their decision about what's appropriate, meaning the individual customer's decision about that, and not mandate as if one can mandate, but even trying to mandate sort of, you know, you have to go to the bathroom of your assigned sex at birth. And it seems like this thing that really is complicated when, in fact, it's pretty simple. But Target then got a lot of exposure and a lot of support and also some backlash. And, you know, it can be difficult for a company to understand sort of what these kinds of decisions mean and the internal implications. How do you also support employees around these issues? And a lot of companies are just looking for a place to think that through. But, of course, they're not alone. They're, you know, the schools are inundated with well, first, just the challenges of educating students and providing a safe place where that can happen. And so we work with a lot of schools and school districts and boards on what does that mean and how do you really create a gender-inclusive school. So we work with a number of groups, but the theme is still the same, which is there's really a sea change happening around gender, and let's all sort of talk about it and see if we can understand it together, and then think through how to create inclusive and supportive spaces for all.
Well, I would certainly agree with what you've said in terms of it really feeling like a sea change for so many people. Let's start with the name of your book, The Transgender Teen. What is that? What is that person? What are they going through? What does that mean to be a teen, a transgender teen?
You know, Pamela, it's such a terrific question. I appreciate you starting there. I think because one of the things that we're really all struggling with is language. And, you know, I think all of us conjure up a particular idea when we hear the word transgender, and we have an image of what that is. And today, the reality of what that is really dramatically different. First, even that word transgender is used in very different ways. It may mean somebody who identifies with the gender across from, if you will, therefore the transgender, across from the gender that they were assigned at birth. So if you were born and, you know, the box for girl was checked on your birth certificate, and we assume then that you're a girl, that then a transgender person would be somebody who was assigned being female at birth and now identifies as being a male. That is actually really different today. A lot of youth use that term to really talk about anybody who doesn't fit society's ideas of what it means to be the gender that they were assigned. So it could be that it's somebody that identifies in a cross-gendered way, if you will. But it also might be somebody who was identified as being a male and still feels like a boy, but likes to wear dresses or skirts, which is not uncommon at all for youth today. And so while we would call that somebody who's really gender expansive, there are many people that would even put that under a transgender umbrella. So the terms, and this is why I think so many people feel, you know, confused and are struggling a bit with this, is I'm not even sure what the vocabulary is, right? And so they struggle with how do I know what that is? And one of the things that we talk about both in the book and elsewhere in our work is it's one of the reasons why we have to really learn how to talk about gender with one another, particularly parents with our kids. We need to understand how they see gender generally and how they see their own gender and the names and the vocabulary they use to understand and even describe it to themselves. Well, and so we use the term in the book, and we describe this in simply for communication purposes, we used the word transgender to really talk about somebody that was assigned one sex and at birth and therefore we assume their gender and now identifies with, quote, the other gender or on the other side of that. But we also included in the subtitle of the book that it's a handbook also about non-binary kids. And if I can just address that for 1 second, Pamela, just while we're still talking about terms.
Please do.
Non-binary is this really huge umbrella term that really can mean anything, except that they don't identify in a binary way, hence sort of the non-binary umbrella. And so what does that mean? If we think about what people associate, you know, most people identify as what would be identified as cisgendered, meaning they were assigned a sex at birth based on the genitals that the doctor could see at the time that they're born or the healthcare provider that was there, whether home birth or hospital birth or whatever. So you're assigned a sex, and then you identify with that. So you have what are considered female genitals, so you're assigned being female, and you are assumed to be a girl, and you identify as a girl, and you express your gender, meaning the things that we see, the way that you, the clothes you wear and the way that you manage yourself and hold yourself and present yourself in the world appears to be a girl. And that's, you know, most people identify that way, and that's called cisgendered. Transgendered, the way we use it in the book, is to just say still binary, but a female at birth and then feels like they're a girl, they actually don't feel like they're a girl. They identify internally as being a boy. And then their gender expression can vary quite a bit. So we use that word transgender, but non-binary is this umbrella that says somewhere, whether we're talking about their body or we're talking about how they identify themselves or how they express themselves, falls outside of this sort of binary norm, and they don't feel that way. They might feel something in between, or they might feel neither. Agender is another type of gender identity that really says, I just don't identify with a gender at all. And what's interesting to me in the work that we're doing is, while a lot of focus is on transgender people, and in our case particularly transgender youth, what we know is that actually the number of people that identify as non-binary is probably quite a bit higher than those that identify as transgender. And so when we're looking at, you know, when people talk about, well, how many people are we talking about, Pamela, one of the things that I'm always really struck by is we just don't tend to ask the question very well, and so we're missing really this sea change that we were talking about. And that actually we're talking about quite a number of youth, not sort of like a 1% or half of 1%. We're really talking about much larger numbers than that.
So when we say youth, are we talking about 17, 18, 19? Are we talking about 5, 6, 7?
Well, it's a great point. So we have, in this particular book, as you alluded to, we're really talking about teens. But we have another book that Stephanie wrote called The Transgender Child, and there. And certainly in our work at Gender Spectrum, we see a full range. The American Academy of Pediatrics, which is sort of the organization for pediatrics, says that they expect that most children have a stable gender identity around age 4, that they can actually identify and differentiate their gender from others by age 3. So for most people, regardless of your gender identity, you have a sense of that identity actually quite early in your life. And of course, for most people, that means that they're cisgendered, and so they may not think that much about it. It's only when there's a kid that comes our way that says, you know what, that's not how I see it, that then we start to say, well, wait a minute, are you really able to know that? Aren't you too young? Well, the truth is they're not too young. Just like everybody else, by about age 4, they have a pretty clear sense of their identity, even if they don't yet have language, of course, to articulate that, which can be a very different issue.
So I think what's clearly very important for those parents who have the child who is insightful enough and verbal enough and trusting enough to go to a parent or another adult and say, this is how I identify, in whatever language is appropriate for that child, for the adult to then say, well, this is just a stage, this is just a phase, you know, at 5 years old, how could you possibly know? At 10 years old, you're much too young. And I think what you're saying is that's not true at all.
Yeah, I think that really what we need to do as parents is listen and not jump to any action. You know, all of us want to make sure that the world is a safe place for our kids and that they have a chance to grow and become the people that they are. And I think that sometimes, you know, part of that natural desire to take care of our kids means that we jump to action. You know, we want to help. We want to do something. Doing something feels a lot more comfortable and is indicative, perhaps, of being an effective parent than just listening. When in fact, often, really, what we just need to do is listen. And for many young kids, you know, they're just exploring. They don't yet maybe have everything classified yet into gendered roles, and they're just having fun because they think it's just fun to dress up. That is a really different situation than for a child that is telling you consistently and persistently over time, you know, no, it's not that I just like to dress up, or that, you know, often for girls it'll be, you know, they'll be told that, well, you're a tomboy, and so there are tomboys that like to do this or that. It's really different when they're telling you, when that child is asserting, I don't just like to play things that I, you know, with boy things, if you will, I am a boy. And that doesn't just come up once or twice or something else. It's coming up, and you're seeing as a parent in your child that there's an urgency and that they're trying to tell you something about themselves that's really important. And that, I think, is Pamela, to your point, is really the time to stop and listen and not try to convince them they're wrong or show them that, in fact, there's many broader ways to interpret, you know, what's possible for them and what's available to them, even within the gender that they were assigned. It's important to just listen and hear what it is they're trying to tell you, because if that isn't received after a certain number of attempts, eventually that child will stop trying to tell you. And I think that's really the danger point, because when that gets internalized, then that's when we begin to see some of these risk factors that, of course, are all too well known at this point, of transgender teens with a suicidality rate of, you know, give or take, depending on the study, but about 40%. In certain populations, that's higher, of course. Transgender youth of color are particularly at risk, so you've got multiple factors there around minority stress factors that take a toll on those youth. But it's, you know, it's an issue for all youth, and it's essential that we listen and that they know that there's a safe place for them to go to think some of these things through and to be in the process of really understanding what might be true for them. So I think it's just such an essential point that you raise, and that it really isn't that they can't know. And also, you know, we just need to be there to hear what they're understanding about themselves over time and to let it change if, in fact, it changes. But if it's persistent and they keep coming back consistently with the same thing, it's really important that both you and they get some support to maybe help them through that process.
You know, I think about the statistic you just cited of 40% in terms of suicidality, and that's just, I mean, 40% of anything is astounding. But that's just an extraordinary, extraordinary number of people. And again, I think it speaks to the importance of adults to really listen, as you say, to get information if they feel uninformed, and to be there and present without their own biases or their own fears.
Well, you know, you're so right. And in addition to the suicidality, not to heap more on that, but I think it is essential that we underscore the risk that these youth face, because I think it's one of the ways in which we're not really taking in the seriousness of the issues, and that there is, I think, a responsibility for all of us, you know, who are adults and can help make a difference in the lives of a young person, that we really need to understand this. Because in addition to suicidality, we know, for example, I mean, there was a terrific study done in 2015 of 900 plus, I can't remember, Canadian trans youth, and in this case, these were aged 14 to 25, so sort of the you know, high school and college age for the most part. And that and the results from that survey revealed that within the previous 12 months, 75% of 14 to 18 year olds had hurt themselves on purpose without wanting to die. So this is some kind of self-harm, whether that's you know, cutting, burning, something that they were doing to deal with the intense emotional stress that they're dealing with, that they're in fact trying not to commit suicide. They're trying not to attempt suicide. And so, but you're looking at, so when you put these risk factors, and then you look at addiction numbers and disordered eating of various sorts, and all these coping mechanisms to in fact deal with this and attempt not to lead to an attempted suicide, you realize that it's really an incredibly difficult and sad situation that needs to be addressed, and we need to provide support and resources to this group of at-risk youth.
Lisa, I'm going to read to you a quote from your book and ask you to explain to the audience how this is the case. You
sure.
Say, "Your gay son announced to kids at school that he always felt like he is a girl and is going to transition to being female. He is not gay. She is actually straight."
Yes, that's a challenging one to understand. So let's address some of the underlying ideas that show up in that particular example, if that's okay.
That's fine.
One of the things that can be confusing is the way in which we combine sexual orientation and gender. And this is one of the things that really leads to an awful lot of confusion. I would say that, and the way in which we associate a person's sex with their genders also leads to a lot of confusion. But let's talk about this sexual orientation one, for example, as a good starting place. One of the things that happens, because there is so little language around gender, is that for many kids, that especially as they get a little bit older, maybe you know, middle school age, and they're beginning to have an understanding of themselves, both around their gender and maybe, you know, sexual orientation or sexual interest in some way or another, even if it's just feelings that they're trying to sort out. One of the things that will happen, because there's so little language around gender, is, but there is language around sexual orientation, is they'll say, you know I'm different. But they don't yet know what that is. And so one of the places that many kids go to first is to say, you know, I think I'm gay. You know, I think that's what the issue is. And so what will happen is they'll try that on. And even though it feels a little ill-fitting, it doesn't quite seem to resonate for them, it still seems the closest. They know they're different, and that's the way in which they first sort of, you know, begin to identify. And so they may communicate that to family or friends or whatever. And as time goes on, the fact that it's not quite right, and maybe they meet other kids as they get older and are exposed to more kids at school or online or other places where they might be going, they begin to realize, you know what, I don't think that's it. There's something else. And as they continue to look at it, they realize, oh, wait a minute, this is really a gender issue, and I was confusing that with sexual orientation, and this is what's really going on for me. So it isn't that I'm, say, a girl that's really interested romantically or sexually in other girls. I'm actually somebody who is assigned female at birth, and we assumed I was a girl, but I identify as a boy, and I still like, I am romantically or sexually interested in girls or women, depending on how old they are. And so I'm not homosexual. I'm actually, my gender identity is different, and I'm straight. So it's because our sexual orientation is determined by our gender and the gender of the person that we're interested in, then it gets really confusing because somebody's interest in terms of the gender that they're interested in romantically may not change, but if their gender changes, then their sexual orientation changes.
I see.
But it's very confusing. So, Pamela, I really appreciate you bringing that up, because I think it's also one of the ways in which, you know, all of us are struggling to understand these terms, and it just gets really confusing. And also, you know, sexual orientation, one of the things that we know around some of the bullying that takes place, and I know you've done quite a bit of work in bringing attention to this issue, and so, but some of the bullying that takes place in schools appears to be homophobic, if you will. The epithets and the slurs that are thrown are ones that you know, have a homophobic basis to them. But in most cases, we're talking about things like that being said, you know, at an elementary school level, for example. That bullying isn't really about generally the sexual orientation of that child. It's really about the gendered way in which they present themselves in the world. And so a boy who present themselves maybe in some effeminate ways, what we as a society have deemed effeminate ways anyway, then, you know, might become, some sort of derogatory term, or we do something that has to do with them that's really inferring that they're homosexual. It's not really about that. What we've done is we've taken these behaviors that we associate with being female, and if a male exhibits those, then we find ways as a society to make sure we let them know they're not living up to our expectations. But so a lot of that sort of playground bullying is really gender-based bullying from a very early age, where, you know, basically as a society we're trying to get these kids to conform to our ideas of what it means to be a gendered person in the way in which we've identified that gender for them. And that can be a really difficult time, and it's important that the bullying be addressed regardless, but to also understand maybe some of those underpinnings.
You know, it speaks to what is certainly important, I think, for everything that goes on in a home in particular, but it speaks to the importance of the adults in the family being mindful of what they're saying, of their own biases, of their own lack of awareness, and not transmitting that to their children. You know, how many times have we seen a two-year-old say something that you know they don't know what they're saying, but they learned that from mom or dad or a caregiver?
It's really true. And of course, you know, we are all, you know, we also get some of these ideas in the ways in which we were being raised, and sometimes they come up in really, you know, ways that surprise even us. And I think we've all been in a case where, you know, we've said something, we realize, well, where did that come from? You know, who am I channeling on that one, because I don't even believe it, and yet there it is out of my mouth. And I think in those cases, what's really important as a parent is to just name that. That's what happened. And to address them. So, you know, we certainly can't expect or hope for perfection from ourselves and others, but what we can do is we increase our understanding and realize why this matters, and it really does matter, that we take the chance when it shows up to stop and look at what's going on, and to acknowledge when we say things or do things that really reinforce gender stereotypes, and to just say, you know what, I'm not sure where that came from, but I really don't believe that, and really help use that as a moment to explain to your child that we're all conditioned in the ways of thinking around these issues, and that's okay. We can't sort of get out of that, but we certainly do want to notice when it comes up, and to name that in fact isn't something that you know, we need to take as truth.
You know, I also think about this schools where there are uniforms, and you know, for a lot of parents, I think the idea of sending their child to a school with a uniform is like, thank goodness, it's a sigh of relief, because
sure,
now you don't have to worry about all the stuff that's associated with children being able to choose their clothing and the designer and all of that madness that happens. unfortunately, even into adulthood for many.
But, that's right.
But for, you know, I think about it now in the context of your child who may see themselves as non-binary, for example. What is a parent to do with that?
Well, it's a great example of the ways in which, really, kids deal with gender in schools all the time and from their earliest days. I mean, the truth is we're talking about and reinforcing gender in a thousand different ways for kids in our schools and elsewhere, of course. But uniforms is a great example. It's one of those ways in which, you know, we're trying to simplify things, and in many ways, and for most kids, we do. But then there are those kids where that particular uniform is going to cause them actually a fair amount of distress. And one of the things that we just encourage schools to think about is allow the child to, if you have uniforms, and that's a choice that's made for lots of reasons, many of which are really good, as you were indicating, but if you're going to have uniforms, then allow the child to choose the uniform that's appropriate for them. And sometimes it's just that simple. Now, for a lot of kids, especially non-binary kids, where they don't feel a strong alliance to a particular gender, that is difficult. And the truth is, maybe one day they're going to want to wear one version of the uniform, and another day they might want to wear something else. And I think ultimately, if the purpose of the uniform is to simplify things and to deal with some of the issues that you were addressing in terms of brand labels and sort of class distinctions around and try to create a more level playing field, none of those objectives are affected by allowing a child to choose which uniform they're going to wear. And so I think we want to just make sure that we don't add additional objectives that then get in the way of supporting all students. There are many ways to get where you're trying to get to, and still allow kids to express their gender as is appropriate to them, and also as they identify. And I think that's what's really important. I think with schools, Pamela, too, you hit on another point which is really critical around gendering. I mean, some of the work that we do with educators is just raising awareness that, you know, it's easy to default into, okay, boys line up here and girls line up here. But not only is that problematic for some students, it's not even as much fun. You know, if instead you choose something that is, you know, everyone who loves dogs in this line, everyone who loves cats in this line, or everyone who, you know, and you can think of the many, many ways in which it can be fun to figure out which line you're going to get into, because the objective is to get them into lines, not to, achieve something else. You can do that in a really fun way that doesn't leave, kids out, and to mix it up so that there's lots of ways. But unfortunately, there's just so many ways in which so Gender Spectrum, we created a film that just came out called Creating Gender Inclusive Schools. And one of the things that we were trying to do with that film, Pamela, was to answer those questions that people often have, which is, what are you talking about in school in age-appropriate ways around gender? And again, part of this confusion is because we think that we're talking about sex, which we're not. But also, there's sort of this mystery around that. What are you talking about with them? And so we did this film, and it really highlights some terrific work that a school was doing in Oakland, California, and just what that community went through and how they chose to address it. And it's a really beautiful film that's really about the community and how they did this. But it shows, for example, a simple exercise that we often work with educators on about, with kindergarten age kids. And it's really about colors. And as you know, if you ever talk to a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old, they have a very clear sense of boy colors and girl colors. And it's just really that simple. And so one of the things we did is, and you see this teacher who takes this, of course, a wonderful assortment as kindergarten teachers can have of all these different colored markers, and they create these three circles on the floor, and they have a place for boy colors and a place for girl colors, and those for both, where if both boys and girls like the colors. And children are given a color, and they're asked to identify, is that a boy color, a girl color, or both? And you watch these kids begin with a color like pink and think, oh, it's a girl color. And then the teacher will say, okay, are there any boys here that like the color pink, and you see a whole bunch of hands go up. And so you see that kid looking at that and realizing, oh, okay, so that's both. And eventually, you know, we don't show the whole exercise, but eventually you see that all the colors are in both. And it's a simple way, you know, we don't have to get into a lot of depth with a kindergartner, but it's a simple way to say, hey, some of the ways that we think about the things in our lives, whether it's colors or toys or the kinds of, sports that you might like or any other thing, isn't really a boy thing or a girl thing. It's just a kid thing. And if you like that, it's okay. You can like that. And it's a simple way to call into question some of the ways in which we begin to identify kids really strongly with their gender. And we know, of course, that this is part of the problem that leads to, you know, the fall off of girls in the STEM areas as mm-hmm. they get into adolescence. And a number of the ways in which children begin to segment themselves along gender-segmented paths, even when, in fact, they have real aptitude and interest and passion in some of these areas that, they would love to pursue, but it's not seen as appropriate for their gender, or at least their understanding of their gender. And so it's really essential that we do what we can to truly try to help all kids realize that, you know, the world is open to them in the ways in which feel authentically true for them, and they should pursue those things. And that a lot of the ways in which we gender areas of study and knowledge are we made that up. And they don't need to turn away from science if they're a girl, even if they have a tremendous interest in that.
Well, you know, what I hear that you're doing is really exploring critical thinking skills with the kindergarten group, which is pretty amazing and pretty wonderful, because you're teaching them from so early on to be expansive in their view and not to narrow their views.
Well, and hopefully it complements all the other work that many schools are doing to really raise awareness that some of the ideas that we get around, you know, putting people in boxes and the perceptions that we have really aren't real. And so let's share with each other our experience. And through that, and that's what you realize even in this exercise with these kindergartners, when they begin to look around and they say, oh, well, there's my friend who's a boy and he likes this color. Oh, well, then maybe things aren't exactly the way I thought they were. Maybe they're not as simple. And one of the things we talk with kids about is the difference between patterns and rules. And that's a really, you know, the human mind wants to organize things into patterns. And that's a completely natural thing to do, and many things fit into certain patterns. But there's a difference between what shows up as a pattern and is that a rule. So while many boys may like to play baseball, there are girls that also like to play baseball. One pattern doesn't necessarily become a rule, and nor does it mean that it's only a pattern for a particular group of people. And oftentimes, that's one of those aha moments for kids where they'll say, oh, okay, well, I get it. The reason why I thought that is I see it. You know, they have experience seeing it that way. What they hadn't thought about was that they took that sort of limited experience and assumed that and generalized it in a way that then all of a sudden it became a rule, and it then excluded others from being able to also be included in that. And so I think that's a very powerful way to help people make sense of what they're seeing, but to also realize that there is a more expansive view available. And if they see that in gender, I hope that they also see that in many other dimensions of their self and with their schoolmates.
Lisa, as I said a moment ago, I mean, there's just so much that we attach a sexual connotation to, you know, whether it's toothpaste or cars or, I mean, it can be anything, a meal, a color. There's just so much that we put a gender and a, you know, varying degrees of sensuality onto the profitability of that item, onto the usefulness of that item, and even onto the power of that item. What do you think we need to do about that? Do we need to be careful, mindful, leave it alone? Where do we go with that?
Well, I think, you know, as you indicate, you know, mindfulness and bringing attention to it is certainly a great first place to start. You know, I think it's once you put the lens on and you begin to, and it's a great exercise to just say, you know, today I'm just going to look at everything that happens with this lens, and I'm just going to see what I see. And I'm going to, you know, look at the news through that lens, and I'm going to listen to the discussion at work through that lens. I'm going to think about my conversation with my kids through that lens. And all of a sudden you realize that it's just an unending barrage of, you know, statements and values, as you say, that get applied to everyday things in ways that eventually we don't become immune to it from the sense of effect, but we come immune to it from the perspective of seeing it. And it's just so much in the water that we swim in that it's really difficult to see what's going on. And so I'd say the first thing that's really essential is for all of us to just look at the ways in which we do that. I think one other thing that's really a helpful exercise to do as an adult is to take, you know, just a few minutes to even walk back in your own gender journey and to think about what are your earliest and initial ideas around gender. And how were those things communicated to you? And what was being told to you about what was okay and what was not okay, what you could or could not do based on your gender? And those are really important things to realize about ourselves, because one of the things that becomes clear fairly quickly is, well, we each made decisions based on these ideas, these understandings of gender that seemed probably at the time as if they'd always been that way and would always be that way, when in fact understandings of gender are changing all the time and the norms change over time. And yet we make sometimes lifelong decisions, whether it's career or anything else, based on these understandings of gender that we've often integrated in ways without very much mindfulness. And so the first place, I think, to start is to really put that lens on and see if you can see the world in the many gendered ways in which they're, you know, we're all sort of each walking through the world every day, and also to look at how our own gender story has played itself out. And I think those are great places to begin because they really help see it. And then I think it is important, especially if you have young people in your life, either professionally or personally, to name some of these things and to say, what is this really saying? And why are we placing so much emphasis on some of these things? And what is society trying to communicate through that message? And it's an interesting thing. There's, you know, every day we do a little video series at Gender Spectrum every week called This Week in Gender. And one of the things we do, and I just do it with one of my colleagues, and we each take something that's happened that week and highlight it just from a gendered perspective, like what was going on around that issue or what is that telling us. And it's a really interesting thing when we look at it. And one of the early ones that I did in this election season, and I want to talk about this from a gender perspective, not a political perspective at all, but I remember during the time when we were, some of the conversation, and there was some uproar in some of the communities that were statues of Donald Trump had been placed, and it was all about the size of his hands and all that. And I said, isn't it interesting that we're talking about something in a coded language where we're talking about the size of his hands, which the implication is that somehow that relates to genitals, and that even then somehow that relates to a level of masculinity. All of that is socially constructed. None of that actually is, and yet we all understood that was the actual conversation being had without ever having it. And I think those are the ways in which we really need to identify and name that and to say, wow, that's some pretty interesting stuff that's going on without our actually ever saying any of that directly.
You know, you mentioned the YouTube conversations. I watch some of them, and they're absolutely wonderful. So I would certainly recommend that folks take a look at that, and I'll want you to give us your YouTube information before we get out of here today. Let me ask you about a couple of terms that come up often. There was a time when referring to someone as queer or calling oneself as queer was perhaps not seen in such a positive light. But now, you know, the terminology genderqueer, genderfree, agender, I mean, there's just so much that is in our lexicon these days. What's the distinction between from one to the other?
Well, it's a great point. I think in many communities that are trying to reclaim language that has been used pejoratively, negatively against them, though within a community, it begins first by saying, okay, we're gonna own this as a term of empowerment instead of ridicule. And then at some point it gets externalized, but the problem is then it gets really tricky because then who gets to use it and how do you use it? And that can feel like a bit of a language landmine if we're not careful. But I think where queer has come in, and as you said, I mean, certainly when I was, you know, I'm old enough to remember that when, you know, somebody said queer, it really was generally being used in a really negative way towards somebody, in a demeaning way. And many youth today absolutely do not see it that way. They really see it as an identity that can mean, again, often used in a very blanket way, where they may just be saying, I don't fit in your, you know, in society's norms, and I don't have a, maybe I don't have or I don't want to use a different identifier that's any more specific. I just want a name that in some way that may or may not be obvious in looking at me, I don't fit into that, you know, your ideas of what it means to be gendered in the way that society wants to gender. And so sometimes it's really that sort of blanket term. Sometimes it's used in a very political way with political intention. And other times it's really being used as a holding, what I see youth using as a holding term, which says, I'm not quite sure. What I know is I see myself differently. I'm not quite sure what this means yet. I'm going to name that just that I know that I'm you know, I don't identify as people expect me to, but I'm in the journey and I don't know yet. And so they use that as a way to identify a process and a journey, and I think that can also be really powerful. I think it really does come back, though, if you hear somebody, you know, you're talking with somebody and they use that term, as with all ways of trying to increase understanding, the best way is to ask them, oh, so you identify as genderqueer, what does that mean? Because that's really the only way we're going to know, and it's also a way to really understand, because after we hear several people identify as genderqueer, and we hear nuanced ways in which that means something different to each one of them, it really helps us understand, you know, how this language is evolving and how do we really talk with one another about gender. So it's absolutely, Pamela, it can be really confusing. All of these issues, I think, around language can be really confusing because language is growing tremendously. I think as you probably witnessed a few years ago when Facebook began providing these gender identities for people to choose beyond, you know, essentially male and female. They rolled out initially, I can't remember now, something like 52 or 54. And I think everybody who heard that initially probably thought, oh, well, okay, we've got this covered. And it probably wasn't more than a couple of weeks where they sent something out and said, we realize we just didn't have this covered at all. And then they added some more, and then they eventually provided a custom gender capability for people to use. And you realize, how is it that something that we have all thought of as being relatively straightforward is actually so much more, at least complex? It doesn't, I don't think it's overly complicated, but it's certainly a little more complex than we thought. It is different than what our genitals are, although it involves our bodies, to be sure. And it's also different than our sexual orientation and who we're sexually or romantically attracted to. You know, I think that gender is really about how we see ourselves and how we experience ourselves. Sexual orientation is really about who we're romantically and sexually attracted to in other people. And those things are just so essential to our sense of self that at some level it's no wonder that it comes up as much as it does in our society. I think what can be discouraging is to realize it is in so many ways that are unnecessary, the unnecessary ways in which we gender things, but also the ways in which we talk about them in as if it's an inherent characteristic rather than one that we've applied. And we know, for example, even the simple idea of pink is for girls and boy is for boys is actually it's not a universal in any cultural sense. But even furthermore, even in the U.S., that's a relatively new thing. It was in the first part of the 1900s where we began, for marketing purposes, to gender the colors of the clothing to increase market share. So it was, there's nothing inherent about pink being any more female. In fact, prior to that, pink was seen as more appropriate for boys because it was related to red, and red being, again, seen as a stronger, more powerful color and therefore associated with boys. So it's, these things evolve all the time and they're changing, but it's essential that we really understand all the ways in which we're creating this context and then looking constructively and analyzing constructively what we're doing and the effect it has, and whether it's helpful in identifying certain patterns or whether it's not, and what's some of the harm that we're doing on a lot of different levels. Harm that we're doing to kids who then don't fit and don't know what to do about the way that they fit, what to do about the ways in which there's a cost to society, because people begin to narrow themselves, to confine themselves, to fit into the gender ideas about gender that we have, leaving lots of, important skills that we need to develop as a society left underrepresented because we don't have enough people that are willing to do that work, because in many ways we've told them that's not work for them. And so, and it certainly affects our families, not only, in terms of the kinds of conversations we have and how our kids see themselves and the opportunities that they apply, but also how we, our own internal division of labor, and the chores we assign kids to do and our expectations of the kinds of things that that they will pursue and the kind of student and a lot of the behavioral expectations. So there's all these things that, it is important that we just have a critical eye to look at them and to just see what we're doing and then to figure out what we want to do about them.
To the parent who has a 16, 17-year-old child, and the parent has created the path for this child, he's the first boy in the family, and they've got him going to college in a particular college, and he's going to marry a woman and a particular kind of woman. So they've got the whole path lined out for this child, sort of without the child's input, which is what happens with many parents. And then one day the child comes home and says, Mom, Dad, I'm 17, and I know you think this about me, and I know I'm like the head of the football squad, and I've got all these girls calling the house, but really, that's not who I am. What would you like that parent to do first?
What a really wonderful question. I think, one of the things to acknowledge is that a parent that's in that situation, especially if they just haven't seen it coming for whatever reasons, it just hasn't shown up, or maybe they didn't want to see it, that isn't about blaming or about judgment. It's just there's many ways in which all of us are so busy and we get into very transactional things with our kids, and sometimes we miss some of these other sort of things that may be going on for them. But whenever, if this comes up for you and you've got this child who you, as you say, you've been, parenting along this journey till they're 16 or 17, and all of a sudden it comes up, one thing to do is to realize in that moment, especially if you're really surprised, really focus on listening, because you're in shock and you're going to need time to process this and learn about it and to try to figure some things out. And so listening to what they're trying to tell you to the best of your ability is really essential. Limit the kinds of things you're going to say, because the things you're going to say initially are going to be reactive and they're going to be coming from a place that you may not be at even an hour from there. There's also, I think, very common for parents is a grieving process. Because, as you point out, Pamela, the creation of our child's story begins before this child's even born. It begins when you read what to expect when you're expecting. It begins with gender reveals. It begins with all of these great ideas that we have about how our children are going to be. And I occasionally tell a story of a trip I made for business, and I'm sitting in my airline seat, and I'm sitting next to somebody, and I remember talking to this person. I don't remember how we got onto the topic of parenting, but they were sort of talking about their parenting experience, and I finally said, "Wow, I have to admit, I've got two kids, and I feel like parenting is the greatest improvisation, and yet you sound, every day I wonder, am I doing the best thing I can, and I see the things I could have done differently, and I hope to do better the next day." And you sound like you really have this nailed down. I said, how old are your kids? And then he says, "Oh, well, we don't have kids yet." I think I laughed for 5 minutes out loud in that play, and I said, when I was an imaginary parent, I was excellent too. Unfortunately, kids seem to really challenge that when it shows up. And
that's a great story.
I think that one of the things we have to do as parents is to just say, it's okay that I feel that I'm certain about what's going on. If I know anything about these statistics, I might feel terrified about what this means. And it's very important we try not to anyway, parent from fear. And so it's really important to give ourselves some moments in that. But I would say that there are some things, we have to be really careful about some initial responses, which might be some coercion, and that's not uncommon. Parents have tried to say, I won't allow you to do certain things. I won't allow you to tell anybody about this. I don't want you to talk about it. I don't want to listen to it. I don't want you to share this with your friends or at school. And those things really don't work. So I would just say one of the things you want to do is make sure you're careful about those kinds of things. Or excluding a child that's now, that a 17-year-old is saying, and now I'm going to start wearing these clothes, and you exclude them from family activities or blocking access to friends or activities, unless, of course, all these are the normal parenting caveats. If there's somebody that's a dangerous person to your child, then, of course, you don't want to do that. But if this is just a friend that they're going to for support, but you think is supporting them in this gender identity process, and so you want to, keep your child from interacting with them, that actually can be really a very damaging thing to do.
Okay.
So there's certain things you don't want to do, and we do talk about that a bit in the sort of damaging practices, but some really simple and affirming things, well, I don't know about simple, sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't, but affirming practices certainly really require respect in the family. And one of the things that you can say to your child is, if you don't understand it, you can absolutely say, I'm just going to be honest, I don't really understand this. I hear what you're telling me, and I'm having a hard time getting my head wrapped around it. Let me have a day to just sit with this, and then can we talk about it, and then just provide some times. And that, your child, before they've ever communicated anything to you, they have thought about this. They've talked about it with their friends. We can tell you that from all the anecdotal evidence. They did not come to this quickly. They've probably been researching it anywhere from 6 months to many years on the internet. They may have a whole community online that you know nothing about. If your child at age 16 or 17 is coming to you as a parent and telling this to you, a couple of things have happened. They've decided that they can no longer live as they are, and they need to live differently.
Lisa, clearly there is much for a parent to think about and be aware of when dealing with their children. How can people get in touch with you or learn more about what you're doing, or even access the YouTube channel? What's some contact information you can share?
Sure, Pamela. Thank you. The best thing really for people to do is to go to our website, because all those things are found there and probably many things that you might not have thought to look for as well. And that's genderspectrum.org.
That's wonderful. Lisa Kenny, co-author with Stephanie Brill of The Transgender Teen, I would suggest a handbook for anybody who has a heart and a mind and is interested in others. Thank you very much, Lisa, for your time today and for the work that you folks are doing.
Well, thank you, Pamela, for having me on your program, and also for the tremendous work that you do and the awareness that you bring. Thank you so much for what you do.
All righty. And folks, thank you for joining me on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications, and it is available to you on demand 24/7 by going to myndtalk.org, or you can simply go to iTunes and download the Mind Talk app. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, you can send an email to pamela@mindtalk.org. Unacceptable? Well, it's unacceptable.